I think something else happened that caused the administration to realize faster than they otherwise would have that this is not going to go down well and it's going to be costlier than the first round of the war. And well, that is what happened in Jordan. Because what happened in Jordan is not just that the Iranians struck an American base with significant precision and got through the air defense systems. We knew that they could do that. It's that the Iranians appear to have had real-time intelligence of what was going on in that base. Because something was happening there that the Iranians found out very quickly, and then within 7 minutes, they struck. Which is very different from what we saw in the first round of the war, in which they had better intelligence, but it seems like essentially they were buying commercial satellite images from Chinese or other outlets that had higher resolution, but it was still 5 to 10 days old. Now we're talking about them having live intelligence. That changes the picture dramatically when it comes to force protection. And well, you combine that...
I'm sorry, go ahead.
And it, combined with depletion of interceptors, et cetera, it created a really bad situation. So even this non-planned plan no longer could go forward, and the administration started to become somewhat desperate for some sort of a ceasefire.
Well, yeah, and I think that's exactly what you're seeing here. I mean, this is what I popped up there a second ago, where Vice President Vance and Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff Dan Kane raised concerns about the fact that if we went in with this heavy strike over this past weekend, that we didn't have enough ammunition to continue going on, and it wouldn't make any difference anyway. It wouldn't accomplish the objective, which is to release the Strait of Hormuz, but it would continue to deplete. And then at the same time, we have this information out here that shows some of the targets that have been hit, some of which you mentioned there in Jordan. But you see that these imagery, that despite the fact the U.S. is trying to tell civilian people not to give these satellite imageries, some of them are getting out anyway, and you see they have very pinpoint strikes. When they shoot at something, they hit it. Whether there's any interceptions or not doesn't make any difference. They're hitting what they're shooting at. What does that tell you about the capabilities after all of this time, all this war since the 28th of February to today? What does this tell you about the military capacity of Iran right now?
I would take it even further back to June of 2025. I think what we have seen is the manner in which the Iranians are learning and improving is decisively faster than the manner that the U.S. or Israel has been learning and improving. Perhaps, you know, the starting points of the Iranians were so low so that, you know, catching up wasn't as difficult. I don't know. You know much more about these different things. But I think, again, one of the key things that happened here is that it was a revelation that not just do they have better missiles, not only can they go through all the air defense systems, now they also have intelligence that is essentially real time, which means that whatever the U.S. is doing in the region, presumably the Iranians know about it almost right away. That's a very, very different picture.
Yeah, it is. And that's just something that we have not had to deal with. We have not, I mean, whether it was the insurgency in Iraq in the 2003 on war and all the years that we fought that, or the Taliban and the 20 years of the pointless war in Afghanistan, et cetera, they really couldn't do anything other than plant bombs and have strikes here and there where they hit somebody as an ambush or whatever. They couldn't do anything here. This is the first time where somebody has the wherewithal and the ability to hit back. And now then, as you just pointed out, they're expanding their capability, and the threat to our forces in the region is continuing to grow. But let's take a look also at one other thing here. That this war not only has been going in a south way, but something you and I were talking about just before we came on the air here, it may also be expanding in scope. As here recently, Ukraine, this came out of nowhere for a lot of people. I wonder if you can speak a little bit about this, because Ukraine struck an Iranian vessel, and according to Abbas Araghchi, also killed some of their sailors. And he says this cannot go unanswered. What do you make of this development?
So we know, of course, that the Iranians have been helping the Russians with drones and other things in Ukraine. Nevertheless, the idea that the Ukrainians would strike at the Caspian Sea, at Iranian vessels, you know, on the surface could look as if the Ukrainians are trying to showcase their capability. They're trying to exact the cost onto the Iranians for their support to Russia. They're trying to perhaps show themselves to be somewhat useful to the U.S. I suspect that there's something bigger going on, because all of those things in and of themselves may may be beneficial to the Ukrainians. But if we go back and think of what Ukraine's, one of its key objectives has been since the Russians invaded that country, is that they try to make sure that NATO enters into the war fully, that the U.S. enters the war fully. Which, of course, if you're sitting in Ukraine, that makes sense. You've just been invaded by a major nuclear power. You're fighting back, but it would be much more helpful to you if another superpower entered into that war in your support rather than just providing weapons, etc. But that was an attempt to essentially get the U.S. to do Ukraine a favor. And we saw even the Biden administration, despite the fact that he gave massive amount of support and used the rhetoric, we will support you forever as long as you need it, no negotiations with Russia and never a deal with Russia without the Ukrainians at the table. Nevertheless, from the outset, Biden said no troops on the ground. They resisted pressure to provide F-16s and other types of things, being very cautious and wary of anything that could actually lead to a direct U.S.-Russia confrontation. But what Ukraine may be doing now is another bite at that apple, because it may not just be that them striking at Iranian ships. They may be trying to merge the Ukraine war with the Iran war. By merging these wars, the Ukrainians don't just become a belligerent in the Iran war. It also makes the United States a belligerent in the Ukraine war, which is exactly what they've been trying to achieve for some time without success. And this time around, it would no longer just be the Ukrainians asking for help, but rather the Ukrainians are coming to the aid of the United States in this deadlock, in this dead end that Trump has put the United States in by starting this war in the first place, in which he doesn't have any good military options. As we just discussed, he started another war or another round of this war with no new ideas and ended up in the same place as before. So the Ukrainians may be trying here to present themselves not as asking for charity from the United States, but coming to the U.S.'s aid. But in that process, even it may not be explicit, merge the Iran war with the Ukraine war. I think this would also be beneficial to the Israelis, because from the Netanyahu's perspective, A, he gets it further, another lease on life for the Iran war, which he wants to have it continue as long as possible. It brings the Europeans into the war with Iran in a way that only has been indirect at best so far. But also, now, attacking Iran, defeating Iran, is no longer about defending Israel. It's about defending Ukraine. And the Ukraine war and its origins is very different from the Iran war, because there, Russia did invade that country. It was a violation of international law. It is a war of defense for the Ukrainians to defend themselves. Whereas in the Iran war, we're talking about two nuclear powers starting a war of aggression in the midst of negotiations against a country that doesn't have nuclear weapons. But all of that will be set aside because the Iran war will be part of the defense of Ukraine, which is seen as much more legitimate in a much larger number of countries and eyes around the world. So I think the merging of these two wars, I'm not saying it's successful or that it will be successful. I'm hoping that the Trump administration understands that the temptation of getting Ukrainian help in a situation in which the U.S. is stuck may be there, but the cost of it is that you then also then end up becoming a direct belligerent in the Ukraine war beyond what the U.S. has been so far, and that the Russians then also will become a part of the Iran war. It's a complete disaster, and I hope that they see it. But I can understand that the initial temptation that Trump may have of getting Ukraine's drone expertise part of the Iran war.
Now, one of the things that, which could facilitate that dire path that you just described is depending on what Iran does in return. And I just put up here Abbas Araghchi a minute ago saying that this cannot go unanswered, all caps he puts in there. Now, if Iran does something and strikes back anything in Ukraine, that would seem to help the idea to merge the two together. Do you think Iran will do that?
I'm not so sure. It may be that they struck somewhere else instead of striking at Ukraine. They'll strike something in the Black Sea when it comes to the something proportionate that is seen more as a response rather than something that further moves this towards a merger. But in and of itself, that action can also contribute to a merging of these two wars, which again would be something that the Ukrainians believe they would benefit from, but is not something that I think the Iranians want. I don't think the Russians want it. Again, it gives war another chance, essentially.
Yeah, we don't need any more of that. Let's Let's just bypass that. Maybe Sanity will hold there and they'll do something non-kinetic. I don't know. It's something we're going to keep an eye on, though. Thanks for that. You mentioned Benjamin Netanyahu a second ago. Well, he is also trying to reinsert himself back into this to keep the momentum. If anybody's saying, you know, the 13 days that the United States was doing, that consecutive thing came to an end over the weekend. Then all of a sudden we didn't do the big ramp up. And now it seems like Benjamin Netanyahu wants to say, hey, don't forget about us.
It will take that for Iran to understand, either for this regime to fall or for Iran to realize that the cost of wreaking economic chaos to the world, murdering its thousands of its own citizens and shooting at everyone, I mean, literally at everyone, at Saudi Arabia, at Bahrain, at Qatar, at Kuwait, at the UAE, at Israel, at Jordan, every single one. I mean, this is what this regime is doing when they don't have nuclear weapons. So imagine what they would do if they had nuclear weapons. I think when this regime is either toppled or it's sufficiently weakened that it knows it has to end its nuclear program and has to change its course. That's really what President Trump is trying to achieve. And I back his fully.
So, yeah, I mean, they're just shooting everybody, Trita. I mean, my goodness, they're just crazy people. You got to do something with that. I don't know why they're doing it, but they're just shooting at everybody. What do you say about that?
Look, I don't think there's been a single visit that Netanyahu has made to the United States since at least 2001, in which he hasn't pushed the U.S. to go to war with Iran or to sanction Iran or just to do something. So it would be completely out of character for him to show up today for Lindsey Graham's funeral, the biggest warmonger of them all, at least in the last couple of years, and not take the opportunity to push for this. And if you have that same push, not only come from the Israelis, but also from the Ukrainians. And on top of that, one other aspect. My suspicion is that the U.S. military wasn't really gung-ho on this, but didn't have the guts to really stand up to Trump when he kind of lost patience with diplomacy. He wants diplomacy to just instantaneously give him results, and it doesn't. And he shifted towards restarting the war. And I think perhaps it was a scenario in which they really didn't present him with a real plan. Instead, that's why we all just saw a lot of things being blown up without any strategic utility. And that frustrated Trump, obviously, because now, you know, he's back of flirting with diplomacy. But then the Israelis come into the picture and say, well, actually, we have a plan. This is what you should do. And then the question is, what is the resistance going to be if it is an Israeli plan versus nothing, or Israeli plan versus pulling out of the war? So I suspect that the Israelis may actually come with a plan, knowing very well that Trump is in one of these vulnerable situations again. He's frustrated that his current bombing campaign has not gone very far. It's not achieved anything. The military is telling him that escalation is going to create all kinds of vulnerabilities for the United States and U.S. forces in the region. And so he's kind of stuck. And at the same time, there isn't an obvious path back to diplomacy because Trump has just destroyed diplomacy so much with his constant return to warfare. And I want to add one point to that at the end of this. But then the Israelis show up and they present a plan. And I think just like they did before, despite the fact that their plan is probably not going to be particularly good, they may be able to sell it as something that is strategically viable, that has that thing that the current plan does not. So I think in the next couple of days, we'll find out for sure where the direction is, whereas this weekend may not have been really the real deal. It seems like the decision was on Friday or Saturday not to go for further escalation, but that's different from saying that there's not going to be one at all. If the Israelis come in with a different plan, they might succeed. And if I could just say one thing about why Trump has really damaged diplomacy, it's not just what he has done in the negotiations themselves and pulling out of the negotiations to go back to war or pulling out of the JCPOA in the first place, or you know, both sides believe that the other side did not really live up to the terms of the MOU. But when you see this deal with the Saudis, in which the U.S. is, you know, recklessly offering enrichment capability, the same technology that the U.S. for 25 years, 30 years have tried to prevent the Iranians from having, apparently we're going to grant that to the Saudis without the inspections that the Iranians agreed to in the JCPOA. But within 24 hours after announcing this, Trump takes to Twitter and he fundamentally changes the terms of the deal and says, well, this is contingent upon the Saudis normalizing relations with Israel. So, you know, you strike a deal, you sign it, you announce it, you brag about it, and within 24 hours, you're changing the terms in a fundamental way.
Yeah.
Now, if that's what you do to Saudi Arabia, a country that the United States has a very close relationship, is a very close partner, on top of that, the Trump family has very close business ties with, then what are you going to do with Iran? What is the shelf life of any American commitment under Trump to the Iranians in any agreement? So those on the Iranian side who always have been very skeptical of any deal with the U.S., and those who have not been that skeptical, I think all of them have become even more skeptical after seeing this. Doesn't mean that, you know, this deal, that Trump succeeded in changing the terms, but it shows again how uncommitted he is to whatever he has signed, that he at least tries to change it. And the way he did is that he just announced that it's been changed. And of course, the Saudis rejected that. And we'll see if this deal even survived this at all. But it just leaves an impression that there's absolutely no value to what he says, no value to what he signs.
And that is, that, believe me, was completely recognized by the Iranian side, who Ismail Baghaei this morning said this.
Do not pay much attention to the media speculation. As I said, we currently have no negotiations with America. The negotiations that we have, and which may genuinely be subject to different interpretations, are the negotiations we have with Oman. They are focused on creating the necessary arrangements regarding the Strait of Hormuz.
So I know you only have about 1 minute left. If they're not going to negotiate with, they being Iran, is not going to negotiate with the United States, only with Oman, and that only about the Strait of Hormuz, where is this war going?
Well, it's actually very important, because if it goes back to the Iranians and the Omanis, they were more or less kind of on the same page before Marco Rubio kind of threatened the Omanis to come to the U.S. side of the interpretation of what should happen in the Strait. It appears that what they're talking about right now is, again, some form of a joint management of the Strait. This is what Rubio rejected before. He did not want to see any joint management of it. No fees, he said, no tolls, nothing, even if it's just environmental service fees. And others in the administration were more open to the idea that there would be joint management, but they wanted other countries in the Persian Gulf to also be part of it. I don't know if it's going to go in that direction now, but it seems now that this war is not going to come to an end, not by them agreeing to an MOU for them to negotiate about the Strait, but for the Strait issue to be resolved. Once it is resolved, the war ends. Now, there may be no shooting in between, but the Strait is not open until this agreement has been found. Now, the question is, do the Omanis negotiate with the authority of the U.S. behind them, or are they negotiating in the hope of coming up with a deal and then selling it to the U.S.? If that is the case, it may very well end up being used by the administration to get a much-needed pause in the war before they restart the war. And that pause is not necessarily because of depletion of munitions. They're not going to be able to replenish that in such a short period of time, but rather because it's better for Trump to have wars in intervals in which there are pauses in between that causes the oil markets to calm down. Get oil prices down, and then you restart the war. Once oil prices go too high, then you go back into some sort of a fake diplomacy, and then you restart the war after a while. If that ends up becoming the case, yes, then I think you will see the Iranians shooting at the ships throughout, and they don't care, and they will not accept the ceasefire, even though de facto it seems like they have. But it will also be a very dangerous situation, because it will cause the Omanis to completely lose credibility with the Iranians, because the Iranians will be suspicious that perhaps the Omanis knew this and they went along with it anyways. If you have that trust bridge, which is one of the few ones that exist in the region, be broken, then truly it will be so much more difficult to be able to get back to any type of a negotiation. Look at what every administration has done. Because there is no trust between the U.S. and Iran, they have used countries like Qatar and Oman to be able to restart negotiations, because they had some credibility, mutual credibility between them and the Iranians. If that is destroyed, how are we going to restart diplomacy?